And now I'd like to welcome John Aylmer to the show. How are you, John?
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. So jumping straight into it, John, as you heard at the top of the show, Black Mask is an anarchist-based news and information radio show, and we haven't ever had an in-depth anarchist analysis of the occupation of Palestine. I was wondering if we could begin with that. How do you view the occupation as an anarchist?
Well, I mean, I think fundamentally the healthy contempt for nationalism, which, you know, finds itself in the core of the Israel-Palestine conflict, is really a throwback conflict to a real sort of 20th century type racial nationalism, ethnic nationalism, where you have effectively on the ground an apartheid situation unfolding in the occupied territories that is based on a conception of the Jewish state and the conception of a Jewish supremacy in social, political, and economic rights in the land that was, before the project began, overwhelmingly Palestinian Arab. And so, I mean, I don't necessarily know if it's a specifically anarchist critique, but it's for sure one of the examples of the pitfalls of the nationalist projects that have shown themselves really over the last 100 years to be real failures. And so, although there's a definite sympathy going on for the Palestinian national movement, the way that it manifests itself under, you know, in opposition to Zionism is, I think, the key focus, and that is that it's opposition to an ethnic religious nationalism that prioritizes the rights of one group over the rights of another. So I think that's the core of the conflict, and the rest that comes out of that are just the symptoms of that essential breakdown.
So one of the symptoms could be that is observed on the ground today would be the blockades in Gaza. Not only on land, but also by sea. I wonder if you could maybe enlighten us on that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, the blockade of Gaza is most commonly linked back to the election of Hamas in January of 2006, but having traveled to the region for a number of years before that, and you can definitely say that the blockade of Gaza long predates the election of Hamas. In fact, it was escalated under that is true, but the Gaza blockade has gone on for 40 years in many cases, and it's important to note that the war on Gaza is a war on the population. Expressly, it's not a war against a particular militant group or another. It's a war on the social and civil infrastructure of the Gaza Strip, and related to the fact that Hamas was the elected government there and in the West Bank as well. The blockade has been expressly put by Israel as an attempt to influence the civilian population and have them reconsider their political options. So in that sense, you have the acknowledgement from the Israeli occupation that because you have collective action against them, that there must be collective punishment. And, you know, something that actually the Toronto Star noted in the first intifada, you know, many of these things are cycles of history that are repeating themselves every generation. But this is something that even the Toronto Star was willing to acknowledge in 1988 at the onset of the first intifada, or what's called the first intifada in 1987. It was probably actually the fourth Palestinian intifada, but acknowledging that the responses from the Israeli occupation are expressly a collective, the target is collective, not this or that particular political stripe, but a war on the population. And so the responses to that, although the options for resistance for the Palestinians are strictly limited, the response is itself a collective action. And so the blockade has been a total catastrophe for the everyday Palestinian, if you can put it in these kind of terms. I mean, you have 90% of the Gaza Strip dependent on international food aid to survive. And you have the irony of this situation is that you have the Gaza Strip is made up of more than 1.1 of the 1.4 million that live there are refugees from southern Israel, so they're refugees from areas that were harmed before they were fled forced to do the Zionist project in the Gaza Strip. So you have farmers who are being starved and blockaded, and previously were you know, the ones who made the desert bloom, which is the, you know, key narrative of the Zionist project. So you always have to acknowledge that when we're talking about Gaza, we're not really talking about Gazans, but we're talking about the fact that you have essentially what is a walled-off refugee camp with 1.5 million people today, but the population doubling every 20 to 25 years. And so you have a real catastrophe on the horizon in the Gaza Strip, a particular tragedy that's aimed and targeted against a population, you know, to buttress the national project of another. So, again, to link it back to the nationalisms, it's quite stark what's going on, and quite clear, coming from a place like Canada or the neoliberal project, which attempts to sort of break down these national boundaries through trade agreements and whatnot. You have a throwback, old-school type ethnic nationalism at play in the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Now, we've been curious over the years at the show here as to whether or not there are any Palestinians that journalists such as yourself have come across that might identify as anarchists, and if so, if they are actively fighting against the occupation.
Well, the political spectrum is definitely more limited for Palestinians, both in terms of the fact that you know, in many cases, anarchism is a can be a luxury that is you know, explored when you have a wide variety of political options. To the Palestinians, a lot of those political spaces have been denied, both in terms of being under constant attack in their social and civil infrastructure, in terms of community centers, libraries, spaces, you know, communal spaces where people can meet. I mean, those have been under attack for the entire duration of the occupation, and so those type of crucial political meetings and political spaces are extremely limited for Palestinians. But in terms of the defining ethics, of course, you have you know, you have a healthy national project going on for the Palestinians, which is in many ways itself a nationalism, but a national liberation project. And when it manifests itself in that way, you don't necessarily get people identifying beyond that national framework in the same way or with the same kind of space that you do in North America. But I mean, the underlining principles that articulated the Palestinian national liberation movement going back 50 years are decidedly left and decidedly social and communist based. And so, you know, that was the principal target of Israel's wars over the past 30 years, predating sort of, if you can define it, but the end of the Soviet Union. I mean, the number one target of Israel's occupation was the left and was that social, political, and communal space, which, of course, is attached to global trends which have seen a sort of rise in Islamist-type theory, but an Islamist-type theory that is very, very, it's predicated upon a social value. So you see groups like Hezbollah or Hamas, although certainly and decidedly not anti-capitalist, are nevertheless providing social apparatuses and social infrastructure as a crucial pillar of their resistance strategy. And of course, you know, global trends as they are, the left is in decline in many regions of the world. And I think it's fair to say that the Middle East is one of those places. And, you know, the opportunities for that type of political organizing have been so thoroughly devastated that you see a rise, with the defeat of the left in many cases, you see a rise in the political space of the Islamist movements, which have themselves entrench themselves on a social level through the community center, through social programs, through education and through teaching, and using many of these, you know, if you can call them left ideologies or tactics in building their political programs. But there's no doubt, I think we need to be frank about the fact that the left is definitely in decline in much of the Middle East.
Now, you mentioned the social programming that many of the popular parties have in the West Bank and Gaza as part of their paradigm. I wonder, we see that manifested in media here, the major media, as a duality, if at all, as represented by our Canadian media or the U.S. media. I wonder if we could just talk a bit more about that, in the sense that How as a media consumer through radio or press or television, would you suggest anarchists that are trying to organize their thoughts or their efforts on the issue of supporting Palestinians in Palestine to disseminate the difference between supporting what the media might or governments essentially are calling terrorism and the community work that also goes on as part of the political body?
Well, I mean, I think the fundamental premise of, you know, whether it's anarchist or not, the fundamental premise of independence and political autonomy needs to be the ability to choose your own leaders or to choose your own way. And so, of course, nothing could be, you know, nothing could be more true to that dynamic than to understand that, you know, people must be able to make choices within their own contexts for what they believe is their own way forward. And so, you know, fundamentally, that's an obstacle for a lot of the left in trying to deal with the sort of Islamist movements and the rise of these Islamist movements, is that there's a lot of tendencies within these movements that put you know, put the anarchists back up and should and are something are you know, grounds that should be challenged. At the same time, you can't separate it from the paradigm of liquidation, you know, to use the frank term, that these groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, as representatives of the Palestinians or of the Lebanese, representatives of resistance to the Israeli project, are targeted for liquidation, and the strategies that they adopt within those frameworks are something for them to decide and beyond our scope. But it's important to understand that the Israelis themselves, the project, the people who are most concerned with the project, realize and have realized greatly through, particularly with the rise of Hezbollah, but the need to target the social apparatus as well as the apparatuses of resistance. So in that way, again, it's sort of like a backhanded compliment to the depth and the social integration of these movements within their own cultures, that it's not, you know, simply sufficient to just attack them militarily and to kill their top political and military leaders. But as we're seeing in the West Bank going on right now with Canadian-backed security forces, Canadian-trained security forces undertaking an American, Canadian, and Israeli policy of what's called the Dawa strategy. And the Dawa is the social infrastructure of Hamas, you know, run through principally through the mosques. And that has been the target, the primary target in the last 6 to 9 months, particularly the last 6 to 9 months, but really since the takeover of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Israel has reshifted its focus to secure the West Bank and to secure the illegal government in the West Bank that's supported by Canada, to do this Dawa strategy and attack the social infrastructure, to attack the schools and the mosques and the community centers, to arrest the teachers and the media workers, and not simply target, you know, the Qassam Brigade's military wing or whatnot, but to actually get at the heart of what it is that creates the popularity of these groups. And in many cases, they're the principles of political action and political autonomy anywhere in the world, and that is accountability to the political movement. And for all of Hamas's failures and shortcomings, one thing that you can't fault them for is being of the people and being rooted within their communities. And you can see that through the collaborationist forces of the Palestinian Authority, just anecdotally driving around in BMWs and Mercedes, living abroad, sending their money to banks abroad. That was the principal dynamic of the Palestinian Authority, was money exiting the Palestinian territories. And since the election of Hamas, you've seen the opposite, even anecdotally, with the bringing of suitcases, literal suitcases full of money into the Gaza Strip, rather than the suitcases of money that used to leave the Gaza Strip under the corrupt regime that was in place before and has been put back into place in the West Bank thanks to Canadian political, diplomatic, financial, and military support.
Now, you mentioned Canada's involvement in paramilitary training, and I wonder if we could maybe briefly discuss Canada's current foreign policy and maybe historically as a reference point, Canada's foreign policy when dealing with Palestine.
Well, right from the, I mean, historically, right from day one, Canada has been involved in the project. You know, many of the great leaders that we make monuments for in Canadian foreign affairs, people like Lester Pearson and Paul Martin Sr., George Ignatieff, you know, we're living the second generation of these guys now, were at the time principal actors on the international stage in the creation of the State of Israel, which was created under profoundly illegitimate circumstances with the ethnic cleansing of 800,000 Palestinians from their homelands, you know, in contravention of all forms of international agreements, which were being worked out at the time to deal with, to make some sort of fair solution for the Israel-Palestine question. And so Canada's been there since the beginning. I mean, crucial United Nations resolutions, such as UN Resolution 242, requiring Israel's withdrawal from the West Bank after the 1967 war, has Canadian fingerprints all over it, and part of the reason why it's never been able to be upheld is because of the type of political obstacle making that we're so familiar with Canadians doing on the stage today. And so there is a real link between the history and today. There's a sort of tendency, particularly among the left, to sort of talk about a George Bush era or Canada under Stephen Harper as some sort of a, you know, a major shift. And really what it's important to focus on is the fact that, that these policies are institutional and they change very little. And what does, you know, what does change, admittedly, between guys like Jason Kenney and Stephen Harper is the language, but not the substance. And so, you know, we've had liberal and conservative consensus on the Israel-Palestine conflict with tremendous support for Israel and breadcrumb-type gestures to the Palestinians going back to day one. And what we see today is sort of an escalation of this, you know, that goes hand in hand with Canada's expeditionary foreign policy that we've seen most particularly since September 11th, but something that began going back into the 1990s with the sort of new world order of the post-communist era, that Canada has really asserted itself on the world stage in an expeditionary interventionist manner, whether it's with forces overthrowing a democratically elected government in Haiti, you know, stretching to today the support for the coup in Honduras, whether you're talking about training and, leading the counterinsurgency war in southern Afghanistan, in the heartland of the Taliban, or, you know, diplomatic and political financial support for the war in Iraq. You know, you have Canadian examples all over the world. You know, Somalia, warships off the coast of Iran. Canada has positioned itself this way and is quite proud of it. You know, Stephen Harper said it gives us a place at the table. Well, in the Palestinian arena, that place at the table has been helping diplomatically, militarily, and politically in cementing the unelected government of Salam Fayyad and Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank to protect against a Hamas takeover, which we saw happen in the Gaza Strip in 2007. A Hamas takeover, which would mean Hamas taking power after an election which gave them a full vote of power from their own people in a free and fair election. I mean, admitting that it took place under occupation, a free and fair election. And so Canada has not done this just verbally, but has done it through literally on the ground, making up the core of the American Security Coordinator Keith Dayton's project to train Palestinian security forces who are expressly anti-government forces and who in the 1980s in Nicaragua would have simply been called Contras, but today are given a certain type of legitimacy. You know, the Contras had to be driven into the basement of the White House, and it turned into one of the great scandals in American history, political history. Whereas this Keith Dayton project to train Contras in Palestine is something that they talk about at dinner cocktail parties and release into the media and press releases as something to be proud of. And the express goal is to make it impossible for Hamas to rule under its legitimacy in the West Bank. And in doing so has led to the arrest of more than 1,000 activists, predominantly Hamas activists, There's been 12 activists killed, tortured to death in Palestinian prisons that are overseen by this Canadian and American project. And on the street, just anecdotally, I returned from Bethlehem just the other day, and Bethlehem is what Tony Blair calls a model city for these security forces. And in the city of Bethlehem, you have a situation where on the street, at any given time, people refer to the government in the West Bank as the Dayton government or the Dayton forces. This is the Palestinian vernacular for the security forces, is to name them after the American general who has a mostly Canadian contingent training these security forces. So this is not something that's a tokenistic gesture, but it's actually Canada at the forefront of the project going on in Palestine right now, which is to create a series of Gaza strips in the West Bank, Palestinian ghettos or Bantustans or cantons or reservations or whatever you want to call them, nominally autonomous indigenous areas completely encircled by a concrete wall, and outside with no borders to any other international state, no independent foreign policy, no independent security forces, completely dependent on U.S. And EU funding and political legitimacy to exist at all. It's an extremely dishonorable position for Canada to be in right now, but one that they're deeply proud of.
There's another growing connection in relationship between Canada and the conflict between Israel and Palestine, namely the occupation. Locally, we're seeing a growing movement towards connecting Aboriginal sovereignty struggle more so on the First Nations end of things as opposed to Aboriginal sovereignty, I guess, connecting it with Israel's state. And there's even talk of establishing an Aboriginal embassy within Tel Aviv. I wonder if you've heard anything about that, if there's been any movement towards that reality, or if you have any thoughts or comments about the connection between First Nations and Israel.
Well, sure. I mean, there's two sides of it. One being there's an interesting narrative that goes on with the extreme right-wing settlers, Israeli settlers, Jewish settlers in the West Bank that are actively expropriating land. And, you know, a number of times that I've interviewed or interacted with these settlers, I've heard on more than one occasion the sort of narrative that, you know, they believe themselves to be, as they said, you know, like the Red Indians coming back to take their land, you know, after 2,000 years in diaspora. So there's that one interesting narrative. And then on the other side, you have, of course, situations where in 1982, when Yasser Arafat and the PLO was under siege in Beirut looking for a place to be exiled to, Russell Means of the American Indian Movement famously said in Minnesota that the Indians of the Middle East were welcome to come and stay with the Palestinians of North America. And so those types of connections are, I think, you know, for people, particularly people involved in both of those struggles, quite apparent. You have, although in a very shortened period of time in Israel, you have a very, very similar project of displacement with the goal of creating an overwhelmingly, if not homogeneously, ethnically pure type of state project within and on land that were expressly not that way in the first place. So you have a settler colonial paradigm that I think is quite clear to, you know, and it's not limited to simply the native you know, in North America, but also is apparent in situations like in South Africa. And many of these terms are interchangeable, as I said. So the Israelis prefer to put the Palestinians in what they call cantons, whereas the Afrikaners preferred to call them Bantustans, and we call them reserves or reservations in North America. In Central Europe during World War II, the Nazis called them ghettos. You know, all of these terms are roughly the same, and the project is roughly the same in terms of strategy, although, of course, the tactics vary. But they don't vary greatly. I was just in the Dehesha refugee camp outside of Bethlehem when there was a unique and really amazing delegation of American natives that had come over to Palestine to interact and to make this kind of connection on a grassroots level, a connection that needs to be made because, as you said, Zionist groups are attempting to use the paradigm of the sort of band council system that we see in Canada that has many similarities to the Palestinian Authority system that the Palestinians are living under, a collaborationist manifestation that is imposed upon them rather than selected by them to create a semi-legitimate but pliable leadership to interact between the national movement and the settler state. And so it was amazing to interact with these native activists, in many cases that are working on immigrant and migrant rights issues in Mexico and Southern California, dealing with the new imposition of the security barrier on the Mexican-American border, the creation of illegal status apparatuses that make give people certain super rights and to deny other people rights. Many of these are very clear to a Palestinian who lives under them every day and very clear to a native or to a Mexican activist. Indigenous peoples who've had a border cross them through their lands, that, you know, to hear these conversations happen in real time was amazing, you know, and to people make the connections, the natives were making the connections very quickly when they were hearing the stories of the treatment of, for example, you know, not even the large-scale stuff like the bombing of the refugee camp, but more the minor stuff, the way that the children are treated you know, as political actors from birth. You know, there's no such thing in a settler colonial paradigm as a child, because a child is going to grow up, you know, to be a native or to be a fighter or to be, as you said, you know, a terrorist or whatever the nomenclature that's being used. You know, the denial of rights of children and the targeting of children from a very young age is something that was so clear for the native activists coming from California or from Oklahoma or from Kansas, and wouldn't be very different than, you know, in a situation like Winnipeg, where you have an urbanized native youth that is, again, you know, driven off their land, ethnically cleansed, denied the social cohesion that allows, you know, collective resistance in a way that is a crucial pillar of the occupation project, whether it was in North America or in Israel or in South Africa, for that matter.
Now, we just have a few moments left, and I just wanted to ask you to sort of bookend our brief chat here with any thoughts that you might have about how, say, left or anarchists from here in Winnipeg and throughout Canada and North America and the West could build bridges to Palestinian movements or communities in your experience?
Well, I mean, recently there's been a significant increase in the type of boycott, divestment, and sanctions activities that allow an excellent avenue into the conflict, both because they support essential Palestinian rights and for self-determination, but are also rooted in the communities that people themselves live in. And so the situation for BDS might be very different in Winnipeg than it is in Victoria, which is very different than it is in the Dehesha refugee camp outside of Bethlehem. Yet they're all pointed towards the same goal, and all using the same kind of principles to understand the interactions between these companies that are benefiting Israel and how they're benefiting, you know, and the cost within the local communities themselves. And so you see in a place like Winnipeg, it manifests itself in different ways than it does elsewhere, and it allows both people to deal with it on the local level as well as interact, you know, with the national project for the Palestinians, because in many cases these various liberations are, of course, inextricably tied together. And that's the anarchist narrative that needs to be, of course, always kept in mind, is that sort of internationalist ethic of linking the struggles beyond borders, beyond national projects, to understand the overlap and connection, which gives strength to the movements rather than weakening them.
Well, John Elmer, it's been a great pleasure to have you back. I hope we can get you back again very soon before you head off to the Middle East again. And it's been, you know, far too long since we've had an opportunity to share thoughts about Israel-Palestine, and I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, and we're going to take it out. John put in a request earlier for some propaganda, and we're going to hear Dear Coach's Corner. And when we come back, we'll have Macho Filipovic's interview with Norman Nowotny. You're listening to Black Mask, the Frequency of Resistance, here on CKW 95.9 FM.
Sickening last week, by the way.
What? What is going on with you here?
That's not. What is this stuff on here? We're hockey night in Canada, and we're talking about saving the world and all that stuff. Let's talk hockey.
Well, that's the whole idea behind December the 25th.
Let's talk about some good guys.
Okay.
Let's talk about the troops.
These questions.